Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slidekick.
Yarr!
Today is May 29th, 2016, and this is episode 110. The Future is Now, a Game Boy Spotlight on SNK. Welcome once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, we're talking about one of my personal favorite names in gaming. That is, of course, SNK. You're probably most familiar with them via games sort of on their Neo Geo console. Lord knows we talk about that enough here on air. But you may not be aware of is that they actually started as a software developer, and some of their early titles are games that you may actually be familiar with already. So please look forward to that. But in the meantime, let us first clear out our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. Slaggy, you want to get us started?
Yeah, our first follow-up is about the Jack's Pacific Nintendo figurines. We have a look at the upcoming ones that will be available throughout the rest of the year. In September, we are expecting a Metroid minifigure, a White Tanuki Mario minifigure, a Bob-omb minifigure, a Tom Nook, Orange Squid, Red Yoshi, Ice Mario, and Fire Luigi. And then sometime in the winter, there's going to be a Green Squid, a KK Slider, a Bloop Bloop, or Blooper, depending on what you want to call it, a Toad, and a Bone Piranha Plant.
Excellent. You know, that's really exciting stuff. Yeah. I have been into the Jack specific line since they really sort of started to refocus. What was that, about 2 years ago now?
I believe so.
And, you know, I've actually been very happy with the quality of the products they've been releasing.
Oh yeah, they're just top notch.
And it's cool to see them going with sort of some stranger picks too. You know, it's super funny because they have a Green Squid minifigure listed and they're calling it like a Super Mario figure. I guess they think maybe it's a blooper here, but like, I'm pretty sure Splatoon. That's Splatoon. Yeah. Anyway, we also, in some really neat news, have word of a new costume in Super Mario Maker. This one is Hello Kitty. I'm, of course, very excited about that. There's also the other Sanrio character, My Melody. Between the two, they are, as far as I know, now available in Super Mario Maker. You just go to the event course, beat it, and you get the costume, as ever and always.
If you missed out on the initial Mew distribution for the current Pokemon games, then you will get a second chance. If you are a member of the Pokemon Trainer Club and subscribe to the newsletter, and you do that before June 1st, so probably by the time you hear this, so hopefully you are signed up. If so, you will be able to get a Mew code for XY, Omega Ruby, or Alpha Sapphire.
Excellent. We also have word here that the long-awaited support for mods in the console version of Fallout 4 is finally on its way. If you're playing Fallout 4 on the Xbox One, you will have access to mod support on May 31st. PlayStation 4 users at this time are expected to have to wait just a little longer, but Bethesda says they are still on track for PlayStation family consoles to get mod support in June. We also have word here that the Final Fantasy 14 patch 3.3 will be launching on June 7th. This adds a new loot dungeon, a new boss fight, and several new events and features for the game. You know, that's really exciting to me. I'm a big fan of what the Final Fantasy 14 support guys do for that kind of content. These patches, it always just has like a lot of really cool features, a lot of cool new story quests. It's just good stuff all around, right, Slaggy?
Indeed. I need to catch up now because it's coming around the corner. Steins Gate Zero is going to be localized for PS4 and Vita in North America and Europe. So if you were looking forward to the ongoings of Steins Gate, then you will be able to participate, even if you're on Vita.
Excellent. Excellent. And we also have, you know, we're already kind of in release date news, but we also have word that Yomawari will be coming out to PlayStation Vita and PCs in North America on October 25th. The two Star Tropics games are both now available as of this week as Virtual Console titles on the Wii U in North America.
And the infamous letter is apparently in the digital manual, so you don't have to soak it in water.
We also have word that the much-anticipated Dragon Quest Builders will be coming to North America in October. You know, that's obviously really huge news. I know a lot of people, both in the Dragon Quest fandom and even in the Minecraft fandom, were really excited for this game to come over, really concerned that maybe it wouldn't. Your fears now have been alleviated. It will be hitting North America in October, PlayStation 4 and PlayStation Vita.
Samurai Rising is going to launch in Japan on June 2nd, so we'll be hearing a lot about that very soon.
Yeah, now that I'm playing way too many mobile games for my own good from other regions, I feel like I'll have to pick this up. Either way, this is the game we were talking about a few weeks ago. It is the ultimate action RPG for smartphone. Talked a lot about its similarities to Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles, so definitely something I'm looking forward to. We also have word that Japan will be getting Monster Hunter Stories on October 8th. Along with a set of amiibo figures for it.
Yes.
The amiibo look really cool. I cannot wait. I will probably end up importing this game, but even if I don't, I will be importing those amiibo.
I was going to say, you're going to import the amiibo at the very least.
Right? We also have really exciting news out of Axis. Just a day or two ago at the MomoCon 2016 panel, Axis confirmed that they will be bringing BlazBlue Central Fiction to the PlayStation 3 and PlayStation 4 in North America in winter 2016. You may recall BlazBlue Central Fiction is the next proper BlazBlue game. It isn't just another expansion to Continuum Shift. It's like a full new game. Please look forward to it. We also have word here that Senran Kagura Shinobi Versus will be releasing in North America on Steam on June 1st, 2016. This is, of course, you know, not necessarily the kind of game I play a whole lot. You know, I'm down for beat-em-ups, but like beat-em-ups with moe girls with big breasts that you can you know, in some of these games do like costume damage in order to get more glimpses of anime booby. Not so much my thing.
Yeah.
I like cheesecake way more than most gay guys, I think. But for me, the ideal is sort of that dead or alive style where, like, you know, they're badass, they're in control of themselves, and they just happen to be like super hot idealized female figures. Either way, if this is your thing, June 1st, we will not judge you.
Speaking of Square Enix mobile titles, if you were wanting to play Heaven Strike Rivals, the smartphone strategy RPG, but you didn't want to play it on a smartphone or you don't have a smartphone, you can get it on PC via Steam.
Yeah, you know, my experience with Heaven Strike Rivals back when it first launched on phone, I didn't love it, but I kind of now want to come back to it. It's always doing like crossover promos, like all the time you're seeing like random like Secret of Mana characters or like even characters from other game companies. So, you know, that's always exciting to me as that kind of nerd. And now I kind of want to get into it.
Yeah, I'm kind of here for this idea of releasing free to play mobile titles on Steam.
Yeah,
especially
right?
If I don't have to mess around with weird touch controls.
Absolutely. And our last release date here comes for Dragon Ball Fusions.
Fusions that'll is be, weird touching.
That'll be releasing in Japan on August 4th. It will be getting a limited edition new Nintendo 3DS release. And, you know, I'm actually fairly excited for this game. This is the one where you can do all kinds of, like, non-canonical fusions of characters within the Dragon Ball world. A lot of really silly opportunities and possibilities here. All right. Do you have anything else, Slaggy?
No, I'm just thinking about how I want to fuse with Piccolo.
Ah, you dirty birdie.
Hashtag Rule 34.
All right. Well, then, let's move on to some news.
News. Oh my god, news.
All right, this first piece of news we have here is a very exciting one, and particularly relevant today. We have word out of Sony that they have added 29 classic Capcom and SNK games to the PlayStation Now library. On the Capcom side, that's Resident Evil Revelations 1 and 2, Strider, Devil May Cry 4 and the HD Collection, Dark Void, Darkstalkers Resurrection, Final Fight, Double Impact, Lost Planet, Planet 3, Asura's Wrath, yes, Mega Man 9, and Mega Man 10.
Wow.
Yeah, that's some good stuff.
That is some good stuff.
On the SNK side, we have The King of Fighters 13, Fatal Fury, The King of Fighters 96, World Heroes, Alpha Mission 2, Magician Lord, Metal Slug, Super Sidekicks, Art of Fighting.
Did you say basketball. Super
Sidekicks? I said Super Sidekicks.
Oh, I thought you said Super Slackkicks.
Baseball Stars 2, Baseball Stars Professional, League Bowling, Metal Slug 2, Samurai Showdown, Shock Troopers, and The King of Fighters 94.
Wow, that's a lot of SNK. How timely.
Right? And for them to have added them just like 2 days ago, it was remarkably timely. Either way, if you're a subscriber to PlayStation Now, you can get access to these games right now.
PlayStation Now.
Yeah, right?
Koei Tecmo has revealed its E3 2016 lineup, including a top secret Omega Force game. So that will be exciting to see. They'll also be showing Neo, an Attack on Titan game, and probably some other gems as well.
Yeah, and that Attack on Titan game, that's the Attack on Titan game that Omega Force did that, actually was very well received. So that's really great news. You know, I am a big fan of Omega Force. Obviously, you know, I love Hokuto no Ken Musou, the One Piece Musou games, the Zelda Musou, the Dragon Quest Heroes Musou, their older work, Winback, Destrega. I'm super excited to see what they have coming next, and I cannot wait for E3 now just for that announcement. That's going to be a good one, I bet.
Yes!
We also have word that the upcoming Valkyria Azure Revolution will be getting new tweaks and changes based on fan response to the demo that came with the Japanese release of the Valkyria Chronicles HD release.
Oh. So,
yeah, you know, I think it's really cool that HD release of Valkyria Chronicles had a demo in Japan for Azure Revolution. And even cooler is that, you know, they ended up getting about 3 times the amount of player feedback than they had expected. They did note there was a lot of harsh feedback, but they said, you know, that based on reviewing all this feedback, they have a lot of good ideas on how to change up the battle system in order to sort of tone the action side of the RPG playing. And it really sounds to me like they have a good beat on what they can do to really make it the Valkyria experience that fans want.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because you see such a trend towards action RPG these days. So that to hear that the fans are like, no, do not want, you know, it's good to hear that they're like not just going to cave into what's popular right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. We also have word here that Bandai Namco has announced in the most recent issue of Jump Magazine that they're working on a new One Piece game for the 3DS. This isn't strictly speaking that surprising, but this game, One Piece Grand Pirate Coliseum, looks like it might be like a sprite-based 2D fighting game of sorts, and that's something that's very exciting. You know, that's not necessarily a genre that sees a whole lot of love these days, especially from these anime adaptations, so I'm really excited to see what this game turns out to be.
Some big Minecraft news comes in the form of PvP. So there will be PvP maps, and if you go into battle mode, you can basically fight for survival.
Yeah, and you know, something that's really funny about this is Minecraft released on the Wii U somewhat recently. As far as I know, it was actually Nintendo's Twitter that broke the news of this PvP battle mode and posted it just before the press release actually went out for this mode across all Minecraft. So just a little bit of silly, funny stuff there. But either way, this mode is going to do super well for them. This is really exciting. It's going to be huge.
And last but not least in the news bits for today, we have word that Skylanders is going to be Hearthstoning, by which I mean they are going to be putting out a digital trading card game.
Well, and it's important to point out that there is a real actual physical card game as well. So this is Skylanders Battlecast, and it is in fact, you know, a digital game. You can get it on for, you know, like off your phone's app store, iTunes, Google Play, Amazon app store. It's actually like a pretty good game. It's well balanced. It does use a lot of the same conceits as like the digital releases of like Magic the Gathering, where if you buy some physical cards, you'll get a code for some digital cards, or you could just buy digital cards on the shop. But to me, the biggest and coolest thing that's going on is that it's actually like a pretty fun game. So I did put this on my phone, and I've, you know, read a lot of criticism about, like, it's a Hearthstone clone or whatever.
A Hearth clone?
But it actually has more than just Hearthstone elements. It also has, like, some magic elements and some Yu-Gi-Oh! Elements.
Oh, come on. Not even an acknowledgement of my wordplay?
Nope. So
rude.
It's actually, I would say, a pretty cool game and worth checking out if you like digital card games, which I certainly do. Anyway, Saigi, do you have any other news for us?
No, no news, but we do have some...
Unfortunately, our first sad story here comes in the news that a former Valve employee is suing Valve for $3.1 million. This is alleging transgender discrimination, misclassification of employment, retaliation for whistleblowing, and more. You know, this is really unfortunate to hear. It completely flies totally in the face of everything we've heard about what it's like to work at Valve. But, you know, people started coming out in the comments, for example, of the original Polygon article that brought light to this lawsuit. Kotaku posted about it. And basically, people are coming out of the woodwork and saying, like, you know, actually, this is a thing. I know so-and-so that works there. And they all keep their mouth shut about these kinds of issues, but they are real issues at Valve. Of course, what's of particular note to me is that they're alleging discrimination based on their transgender identity, which is, to me, really just super sad. Valve is a company that we all think of as, like, very liberal, very, you know, definitely, like, humane and making good choices for their employees. So it's so sad to hear that there are discriminatory practices going on there, potentially.
Yeah.
Very unfortunate. Also unfortunate is the word that Shane Bettenhausen's recent upstart website, Sifted, this is, of course, sort of meant to be positioned as almost like a Reddit or Dig just for video game news. You're probably familiar with Shane for his work at 1UP.com, the print edition of Electronic Gaming Monthly some time ago, the digital EGM stuff, the 1UP podcasts, including 1UP Yours, Retronauts. Unfortunately, the offices of Sifted were last night broken into and savagely robbed, to the point that literally hundreds of games were stolen. All of the boxes for equipment was stolen, so it sort of gives the impression that not only did they steal the equipment, they actually took the time to box the equipment while they were broken in. So it's just a really savage crime. Very, very unfortunate. And, you know, Shane was saying on Sifted's front page that, frankly, this could be the end of Sifted only 2 months after they've launched. Either way, our hearts and thoughts go out to you guys. That is just a huge loss to the community. And I feel so, so sorry for your personal losses and sort of the unpleasant baggage that comes with this kind of break-in. It's a really tough spot to be in, and I'm so sorry this happened to you guys.
Yeah, that's very, very unfortunate. We hope that things work out for the best.
In other news that is fairly controversial...
Controversial.
Oh my god.
Well, the first piece of controversial news here is that No Man's Sky has been delayed into August.
Wait, that's August the controversial 9th part?
In particular. No, the controversial part is that basically every step of the way that this news broke, first, you know, Kotaku broke news of the leak the day before it was official that, you know, their sources were indicating that this was going to happen. And Kotaku, and particularly Jason Schreier over at Kotaku, started getting a lot of very violent death threats. A lot of the people from a certain faction of the games community that we don't talk about by name here on the show, you know, a lot of those sorts were basically saying that Mr. Schreier must be making this up. He has a new book to sell. He needs publicity. This is a fake delay. It's a smear on the face of Hello Games. How dare they? Some people threatening to find Jason Schreier's house and do murdery, rapey things. All because
of No Man's Sky?
Rumor that a game was being delayed. And, you know, the crazy thing is, Obviously, when the news of the delay became official, nobody apologized for it, but for, you know, the way they acted. But a lot of people first were like, oh, this is Sony covering face for Kotaku. They're just going to sit on the game for 2 months. They're not going to release it just to protect these sneaky press fucks.
I mean, it's not even paying attention to the fact that Sean Murray was saying, like, oh, we need to add some polish to it. They think that's all a cover up.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
I mean, all I've got to say is that it didn't look like there was a whole lot of gameplay to it.
How is that relevant to the conversation at hand?
I'm just saying it did not look like it was a game that was ready to come out. So
I'm going to disagree with you there, even though I agree with you that, like, to me, it looks boring as shit. But that actually is the game they're trying to make. It's just not a game that is necessarily, like, the gameplay is really going to be more in the exploration. And,
oh, it's emergent gameplay?
Yes, oh. which I'm typically a fan of. I just, man, you know, so a lot of these people, these complainers, these really toxic personalities, not only did they go full tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist about all this, they then also started sending Sean Murray personal threats and death threats and
oh,
violence
boy.
Threats. Hello Games generally getting a lot of threats. So, you know, something that's been sort of a running dialogue both on our show and basically every reasonably minded person who knows anything about video games and video game culture in the modern age is that this shit is going too far. Now,
yeah.
It has been too far for like 20 years, but it is somehow going even further in this last year or two. And I unfortunately, you know, outside of, you know, new legislation that, you know, I don't know, you know, new legislation that actually gets enforced on digital threats, not just the concept of credible threats or whatever. I don't know what's going to stop this, but it needs to stop. This is so gross, and I hate this kind of discourse in the scene.
Yeah, and I mean,
obviously, we're going to continue doing what we do. We want to be voices of positivity within this space. But holy moly, we can't all be strong forever. This is scary stuff that's still going on every day.
You know, I do not advocate the tactics that this faction of the community uses, but I just feel like somebody in a position of power needs to make them cry like anime fans on prom night.
Well, I guess that's a segue. So the other one of the other controversial pieces of news that we have here is that Mighty No. 9 had a new trailer come out. And that would be really exciting. But unfortunately, Deep Silver apparently took it upon themselves to put this trailer together about a month before Mighty No. 9 finally comes out. And this trailer has a voiceover that is so bad, it is actively offensive to a lot of this game's anticipated player base, including references such as the one that Slagkick just made, where the narrator tells potential players that they will make the bad guys cry like an anime fan on prom night, which is disgusting and reductive and
I know that
so unpleasant.
I know for a fact that you and your fellow anime fan friends had a wonderful prom night. I've seen the pictures of it.
Okay, well, that did happen, yes, but you know, unfortunately,
can we also just talk about the fact that this game looks like crap?
Honestly, that's not
it's not controversial.
No, but that's not a level of discourse I want to participate in. I don't see how that makes us any better than Kotaku shitting on Daisen Ryaku 7 on the original Xbox for looking like dung. No, if the game plays good, then it plays good, and I'm here for it. Okay, the explosions look like someone just super sampled a pizza, but whatever. As long as the game is good, I'm gonna be down. I'm just worried. Stuff like this trailer makes me feel like, you know, Deep Silver doesn't know what to do with a game like this. Most of their marketing efforts have been in relation to games like Saints Row or Dead Island. And you may recall they did some similar advertisement fuckery with Dead Island, where they had the box case that was the shape of like a zombie woman's breasts. So I'm worried about Mighty No. 9. Not as a game. I actually think Mighty No. 9 is going to be an all right game. I'm worried about it from the perspective of how the publisher is already treating it, and it's not even out yet. So I'm definitely worried about that. We also have here controversy because Capcom has showed off renders of the upcoming Mega Man cartoon. Now, this is a reimagination of the Mega Man character. The show is going to be done by the same studio that did Ben 10 and Generator Rex. And so it sort of has their look about it. That sort of very, like, heavily shaded, almost like a Flash style of animation. But without actually being one of those Flash animated shows, as far as I know. So either way, you know, a lot of people are very upset about this design. Really absolutely hate it. A lot of fans on the internet, including people like Jeremy Parrish, are saying, you know, that it looks like Capcom saw Mighty No. 9, saw how Mighty No. 9 was being designed for 2016 and wanted to give Mega Man a similar design. Well, you know, to me, and I do have to say, I actually don't think it's that bad of a design. It's important to realize, first off, that this is the design they're using for a cartoon kids show. But second off, if we do get a game that uses this design, so what? If it gets kids interested in Mega Man, if an 8-year-old now can enjoy Mega Man as much as 8-year-old me enjoyed Mega Man, that's going to be enough for me.
But what if it's like a Mega Man boop bop?
Maybe it will be, but the alternative is no Mega Man at all.
That's true.
If Mega Man Book Bop ultimately gets us a new Mega Man of some kind 5 years from now.
Boop Bop, thank you.
Boop Bop? Okay, well, I guess I assumed you were trying to say it was like an edutainment game.
No, I meant it like a trashy touch game.
Why? You always act like touch games are so trashy, but they're not inherently bad. Admittedly, a Mega Man touch phone game would probably be pretty bad. But it wouldn't necessarily be. Either way, to me, I don't think it's that great of a redesign, but I also don't think it's, like, so bad that I'm, like, mad about it. Like, even all the people I know who are reasonably, like, calm and collected and intelligent were, like, losing their mind over this. I just don't get it. But either way, very controversial news. We also have here, and this is controversial for all the right reasons, there was a Stellaris mod for the recent Grand Strategy games set in space. This is published by Paradox. There is a mod for it on the Steam store or in the equivalent of what Paradox uses for managing their mods, where basically it made all characters white regardless of ethnicity that you selected. They would still show up in-game as Caucasian with European names.
That's gross as hell.
And basically Paradox said to Eurogamer that they shipped the game with an accurate representation of humans. Specifically, they really worked to include diverse ethnicity and personalities in the game. And while they do embrace the idea that, you know, players should be able to mod games to play how they want to play, they do not want to enable discriminatory practices. And I just have to say, fucking bravo, Paradox. I think right? That is fantastic. And I actually bought Stellaris because of this, because I wanted to support this kind of action, frankly.
Yeah, the fact that sort of mod exists is, it's terrible.
You know, it is very unfortunate, but unfortunately, you know, crappy people gonna be crappy.
Yeah, I mean, just look at the Rust community.
And last but certainly not least, we have interesting word here. The director of Uncharted 4, Neil Druckmann, was talking about some of the focus testing sessions they had for Uncharted 4. Now, I'm not going to get super spoiler-centric here, but, you know, there is a female character with a great deal of power that is very cool toward the end of the game. I say power, I guess I mean agency. And basically, they had a focus tester who was very, very upset about that character at their focus testing, and apparently made such claims at, not you too, Naughty Dog. God damn it, I guess I'm done with Uncharted. This fucking bullshit. So, I think that's really fascinating, but I also love that Naughty Dog and Neil Druckmann, you know, they basically saw this person in their focus group and were like, nope, your opinion does not matter to us. They kicked his ass out. I think that's awesome. Slaggy?
I agree. And again, just, you know, can we please have diversity in games? It's not going to hurt you. It's not going to take away your titty. I mean, like, I'm sorry. I can't. I mean, well done to Naughty Dog, but just the people that react this sort of way, no.
All right. Well, moving on, we do have for you three Smash articles today. The first was run on Kotaku. Kotaku. This is Bringing Yakuza to the West is Still Tricky. It is a largely translated interview via Famitsu, courtesy of Kotaku, where basically Toshihiro Nagoshi-san is talking about sort of the struggle and the work it takes to bring the Yakuza games, the Ryuga Gotoku games, to Europe and America. And, you know, it's just a really interesting perspective to see from him where, you know, he's sort of talking about how, you know, in places outside of Japan, basically, the quality of the game is almost irrelevant. Like, the game can be, like, the best game ever made, but if, like, there isn't the appropriate level of advertising, people won't seek it out. So I just thought that was a really interesting sort of angle to look at this sort of thing. I know a lot of people talk about how it doesn't cost a lot for Sega to bring the Yakuza games over, so they should just bring them all over. And it's like, yeah, but if they want the game to do anything, in North America at least, you're gonna have to have a pretty big marketing budget. So it's just interesting to sort of hear it out of the horse's mouth is all.
Yeah.
We also have here a really fascinating piece.
I almost want to call it fun.
Well, it kind of is a fun piece. It is the story of the old PC game TIE Fighter and how it had a piracy leak in 1994.
On the internet.
On the internet, of course. But it's just sort of a really interesting read because it's almost like industrial espionage. Like, it's a pretty wild little story. Definitely one I would recommend you check out over on Kotaku. And last, but certainly not least, we have a really, really fantastic piece here. This is courtesy of Eurogamer.net, and this article is That Time I Was Blacklisted by Sega While Editing a Sega Magazine. This is by Keith Stewart, and it is an article all about exactly what that subject line would have you think. Really cool piece. Basically, he was writing for one of the official Sega magazines, like I think it was the Dreamcast one, and he upset Sega, and so while he was still working for the official magazine, they were not providing him with proper materials and game exposure. And it really ties into, you know, we've talked a lot here on the show about Sega over the years and how one of the big issues Sega had was sort of this really bad, super toxic infighting where within two divisions you would have people actively sabotaging each other to the point that it was like tearing Sega apart from the inside on some levels. So it's really fascinating to see that that carries over even into things like the official Sega magazine.
Yeah,
it was and how Sega Internal treated them.
It was apparently because he ran a feature about how to run imported games by disk swapping to bypass the region lockout.
Which, you know, is something we all did back then. like, what the heck? Either way, I thought that was a really great piece, and you should check it out. We will link you over on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
All right, Slaggy, are you ready for a discussion here?
Let's sneak into the discussion.
All right.
I tried.
So, SNK.
Or we should sink our teeth into it.
That was better. SNK was originally called Shin Nihon Kikaku, which, of course, New Japan Project.
It was an Evangelion?
It was not like an Evangelion. Jeez. The name was shortened to SNK in 1986. They were actually founded on July 22nd, 1978, as the Shin Nihon Kikaku Corporation. They were, of course, sort of refounded after they closed up shop in August 1st, 2001 as Playmore Corporation. You may recall the SNK Playmore era, which only came to an end recently. We are going to talk about that, but we're going to first talk a little bit about the history behind SNK first.
It really is an interesting history because, you know, we are often familiar with, like, the history of Sega and, you know, the history of Nintendo and the history of Namco, but SNK is one that, you know, a lot of us are aware of, but, you know, maybe don't really think about, like, oh, how did that kind of come to be?
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, SNK sort of got its start when Eikichi Kawasaki-san sort of noticed that, you know, the coin-operated video game market, specifically, like, arcade games, was really rapidly growing, and so he formed SNK specifically to develop and market standalone standalone coin-op games. The first two were Ozma Wars and Safari Rally. These, of course, are games you may have seen if you were going to arcades in the early 80s. They didn't really stick around a whole lot. That's crazy to me. You weren't born yet. Holy moly. So, well, I wasn't born when Ozma Wars was made, but I'm pretty sure I saw Safari Rally in my lifetime. So, you know, the games were okay themselves. Nothing to super write home about. But they kept at it and created Vanguard in 81. Vanguard is actually sort of like a proto-Gradius. It's one of those games that I think when people mention that they're like super into Gradius, I'm like, interesting, have you played Vanguard? It is a side-scrolling shmup, but it's before the sort of design conceits that you come to expect from shmups is really solidified. So it's sort of an experimental game. They had Centauri come out not too long thereafter, and they ended up opening a North American division, SNK Corporation of America, in 1981 toward the end of the year. They were established in Sunnyvale, California, which is actually very close to where the Game Boy Studios is.
Yeah.
And the man chosen to run the American operation was actually John Rowe. You might be familiar with him as the founder of Trade West, although this predates that. And he's currently actually the CEO of High Moon Studios, which I believe they're currently working on Destiny stuff for Activision.
Nice.
So, you know, he's still a name in the game. And, you know, I have to point out, you know, we've talked here about how in the Bay Area, we used to get a lot of American location tests for games, particularly Capcom and SNK games. The reason we would get SNK games on location test here is because, you know, one of the biggest competitive arcades in the late 90s, early to mid 2000s was actually located in Sunnyvale. So that same town that SNK was located in.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of a little bit of interesting trivia for you. But basically, as time went on, SNK Corporation of Japan were doing video games for arcade use, and they actually started pretty early to develop games for consoles as well. And they actually, in 87, started doing like NES ports / Famicom ports, stuff like Mad Crasher, Alpha Mission, Athena. Athena was actually a pretty popular game. But the big one, the one you're probably most familiar with, is actually Ikari Warriors. That was an arcade game released in 1986.
Okay, you can't have a game called Ikari and tell me that this isn't Evangelion related.
It was ported to the Atari 2600, 7800, the Commodore 64, the Amiga, the Amstrad CPC, the Apple IIe, the ZX Spectrum, and the NES. That game was actually super popular. And, you know, unfortunately, the home video game market was still suffering from the fallout of the video game crash of 83. But since Nintendo had actually come out of the crash in better shape than ever, and, you know, we've talked about that here on the show as far as, you know, the robotic operating buddy and getting a new foothold in a video game market that was effectively untapped after the crash. SNK signed up to become a third-party developer on the NES. And, you know, that's actually a huge part of where we got games like Baseball Stars, Crystalis, which both were very popular games on the NES platform. As sort of the games industry move forward, though, it was clear, you know, Sega started to hype the Sega Genesis. Hudson Soft was working with NEC to bring out the what we know of as the TurboGrafx-16, but, you know, the PC Engine. Nintendo, of course, was working on the Super Nintendo. And so SNK sort of was like, well, let's focus rather than doing home stuff and porting to all of these different consoles where only one version of the game is going to sell and the rest we're going to lose money. They actually decided to double down on the arcade scene. What's really funny about the way that they did that is that they actually effectively made I don't want to call it a console, even though obviously it eventually became a console, but you know, up to that point in the mid-80s here, arcade cabinets in general were good for one game and one game only. You would have the JAMA board or whatever kind of board you had in there, single game, and basically SNK thought, hey, we'll make a new arcade hardware that will take cartridges. And that way, you know, we'll sell the cabinet itself for a little more than a normal cabinet would be. But then you can buy these other cartridges for just, you know, $500 or $600. And you'll have like a whole new arcade game, basically.
Yeah, that was revolutionary.
Oh, it was huge. And, you know, you would actually, as an aside, that same sort of scenario ultimately ended up being straight up copied by Arcade King's Capcom.
Mm-hmm.
The CPS board is based around that idea. So, you know, the board that ran, you know, Street Fighter 2, Alien vs. Predator. I'm super drawing a blank on so many CPS board games right now. Oh my gosh, the Dungeons & Dragons games, the Tower of Doom and Shadow over Mystara.
Yeah.
Anyway, a lot of their games took this exact same concept that SNK totally pioneered. Arcade operators loved this. This was the Neo Geo Multi-Video System. That is MVS. And, you know, that's why, you know, so many people bought these. This was such a huge hit. That's why even now, like, if most, like, laundromats or whatever, like, if you look in the corner, you'll probably find in a lot of laundromats, they'll still have some of these old Neo Geo machines.
Yeah, and I feel like even, you know, I didn't grow up in a very big town, but, I mean, you could go anywhere and find a Neo Geo cabinet.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it really helped that, you know, what SNK did was they really cultivated some really talented designers and programmers to really make some top-tier software that I would absolutely say still holds up to today.
Indeed.
So, with the MVS, of course, being an immediate success, you know, these new cartridges that you could get depending on the game for, you know, $500 to $800, which was, you know, well more than half of what an actual, like, stand-up arcade cab would have been back in the day, this was a hit. It was an absolute hit. And so SNK started to look at sort of how else they could leverage this cartridge system that they had designed. So they created the Neo Geo family branding and made what is called the Neo Geo Advanced Entertainment System. This is the AES. And that's important, you know, for especially modern day Neo Geo fans. If you're looking for Neo Geo cartridges, a lot of times now you're just going to be looking for cart-only games. You're not going to find the proper boxes and what have you. And so knowing if you're getting a cartridge made for the MVS or for the AES is like a big deal. because even though the arcade hardware and what turned out to be the home hardware have effectively the same internals, they actually don't use the same cartridge connectors, so you would have to buy an adapter to use them sort of crossover style. Either way, initially the AES was designed specifically to be used on like planes and in hotels, but SNK actually had a lot of feedback from fans that they wanted to own these in their homes.
So these were like the prototypes of you.
What do you mean?
Like gamers like you.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's true. So
except you were like 10.
So basically what SNK did was, you know, they had their studios that they had start pumping games out. They started publishing third-party Neo Geo games after this point. So getting third-party developers onto both the MVS and the AES systems. And you ended up with stuff like ADK's World Heroes, Voltage Fighter Gaukaiser, a couple of like Double Dragon spin-offs. So it was, you know, they ended up doing pretty well for themselves as far as really being the first like arcade experience in your house. That was really what they were selling, was the idea that, you know, you could play Samurai Showdown or Fatal Fury or Metal Slug at home. You could play the actual arcade version, not some downport, not some similar game with the same name, which you saw a lot in those eras. In fact, their own Athena was one of those. The arcade version of Athena and the NES version of Athena are completely different games, similar in name only. So they very, very specifically went after the people who wanted an arcade experience at home.
They really did what Sega and Nintendo.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But the unfortunate thing is that the console version, due to the power in the console, actually released at $599.
And that's my Neo Geo memory.
And you have to remember, We're talking about $599
in 1990 money.
In 1990 money, exactly. And by the time most people, especially in North America, were familiar with it, they had actually changed it so that it came with a pack-in game of Magician Lord, but was $650 now. They did end up selling like a budget version for $399. That $599/650 release, that was the Neo Geo Gold box. They ended up doing one that was not gold. It only came with one controller rather than two. It came with no games. $400. As you might have guessed, unfortunately, particularly in North America, the Neo Geo was not a terribly successful home console. In Japan, it did, you know, notably better, but still did not, you know, break records. They had their fandom. People loved what they were doing. So they actually did work on trying to make a more affordable version of the Neo Geo hardware. They got away from sort of the technology of cartridges. They released the Neo Geo CD in September of 1994.
Oh, you're not going to say anything about the cost of Neo Geo games?
Oh, yeah. Well, Neo Geo games themselves would cost, they would start at a baseline of $199, and ones that used more memory that were sort of later produced, you'd sometimes see these things releasing at, you know, $450 to $600.
And I remember for the cartridge. I remember seeing like a JCPenney Christmas catalog. It was like $299. I was like, that's got to be wrong. Like, I mean, this is funny. A time where, you know, like games like Chrono Trigger like retailed for $89, right? If I recall correctly.
Yeah. I mean, we'd have released is like Phantasy Star 4, its retail price was like $109.99. So
that's a budget title compared to the Neo Geo game.
Right.
But like, and then the controllers were like basically like full like arcade pads. Or
yeah,
whatever.
They are full arcade sticks.
Arcade sticks.
They have arcade buttons are like arcade quality of the time. Obviously, it's not like modern day Sanwa buttons, but at the time, like they were better than the buttons you would find in an actual arcade. So I mean, this was a premier prestige item. It was really beautiful.
Did you have one?
I did not have one then. I only got mine about 3 or 4 years ago. Even back then, I didn't really know many people who had one. I knew a lot of gaming people. And even if we weren't super close, anytime one of us got like a new score, we would still talk about it.
Right.
But Neo Geo was one of those ones that it was almost like the holy grail for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, Neo Geo to me was always just an expensive thing in the catalog. And then, you know, arcade games.
Yeah. So the Neo Geo CD released in 94 in Japan, 95 in North America. And the goal here specifically was actually to release the same games as the Neo Geo cartridges, but on the cheaper CD format so that they could sell those for $50 to $80. They got the price of the unit down to $399.
Wow.
But unfortunately, the CD-ROM drive was a one-speed CD-ROM.
Ooh.
So unfortunately, especially these big sprite-heavy games with lots of data in the art assets would have very long load time.
Ugh, like how bad?
I mean, it wouldn't be uncommon if you're playing Fatal Fury or something to have multiple minutes before a match started of load time.
Wow.
Interestingly, no, I did not. That's, you know, my problem is I've literally never seen one. If I ever see one, I'll probably grab it. But I've never seen one for sale, I should say.
Yeah.
I've seen them at conventions, people just showing them off, but not as something for sale. The only game, and I actually do have a Neo Geo CD game, which
just for the LOL.
Well, you know, because I've sort of always assumed I would someday get one. I actually have a copy of the Samurai Showdown RPG.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, and you know, that's cool. I've never actually played it, unfortunately, but maybe someday. But something really cool about the Neo Geo CD is that it does have its own control pad. It's a stick, but it's almost the style of like an analog stick, though it is not analog. It's actually very similar to the little stick that the Neo Geo Pocket ended up having.
Cool.
Yeah. There were two versions of the Neo Geo CD. Actually, three. The first is a front-loading one. It has like a disc tray that pops out. It was Japan only. The second was a top-loading version. It's the same hardware, but with a open flappy lid, you know, a similar transition to what we saw with the Sega CD, even here right. in North America. And then the third one was the Neo Geo CD-Z, which actually had a faster CD-ROM drive on it so that it could load games faster.
Oh, that's the one we get then.
Unfortunately, it was only released in Japan, but my understanding is that actually with the better drive and everything, that that one's actually like an okay gameplay experience.
Yeah, that's the one to get then.
And the note I was going to say is that, you know, despite having these this control pad that was different from the arcade one, the previous home release one, which were prestige controllers, you could still use those controllers on the Neo Geo CD. They specifically had the same controller port so that controllers are cross-compatible both ways. I actually thought that was a really neat and very forward-thinking idea at the time.
It really is.
The SNK also made the Hyper Neo Geo 64.
Oh, boy.
This ended up being an arcade-only piece of hardware. It only ran a handful of games, Road's Edge, Samurai Showdown 64, and Fatal Fury Wild Ambition. As far as I know of those games, only Fatal Fury Wild Ambition got a port to like a more common console, which is a real shame. I played Samurai Showdown 64. The arcade at my local mall actually had a cabinet of it, and it was on like a big monitor, almost like Vulix style, but at the time, like, that was uncommon, so it was really cool. It's a pretty neat game that, as far as I know, has not survived in any way, which is exactly the kind of thing that we like to talk about here on the show.
Yeah.
It's almost like a 3D fighting game version of Samurai Showdown 64, while still feeling distinctly properly Samurai Showdown.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool game. There was a home version planned, but obviously that never came to fruition. What did come to fruition, though, and in many ways was probably the most successful piece of hardware that SNK ever made,
it's
is
your
the
beloved
Neo Geo Pocket. And yes, I would call it my beloved.
Your Neo Poke.
The original Neo Geo Pocket was a black and white console released in Japan in October of 98. And basically, you know, it is considered overall an unsuccessful console, but it actually did quite well, particularly in light of, you know, how the Neo Geo home consoles went. Neo Geo Pocket is forward compatible with most Neo Geo Pocket Color games. Neo Geo Pocket Color, of course, being the next console we are about to discuss. But basically, SNK really went all out in-house and with third parties and just got a ton of great software made for this thing. So the Neo Geo Pocket Color, released in Japan March 16th, 1999, so literally just like 6 months later, released in North America August that same year, and in Europe that October. I had the introductory price of $69.95, and I actually got mine from my local EB Games store. It did sell worldwide more than 2 million units, which may not seem like a lot, but again, you have to consider all of the Neo Geo CDs sold less than 500,000 units. So, so this was still a step in the right direction for them. Unfortunately, when it released, SNK was in a fair amount of financial trouble, and it ended up getting bought out by an American pachinko manufacturer, Aruze. Unfortunately, Aruze actually did not support SNK's video game business very well, and they ended up calling it quits on the Neo Geo Pocket family on June of 2000. So, it's really sad stuff. There are some really fantastic Neo Geo Pocket games. It's funny because I think there are probably only like 50 games overall, if that. Oh, 83, according to Wikipedia. Thanks, Wikipedia. But there were actually a lot of really cool games. We talk about some of them here on the show. One that is, of course, worth pointing out is that it had a game, Evolution Eternal Dungeons, which is actually like straight up a sprite-based port of the Dreamcast JRPG Evolution. Evolution was at its time a big deal because it was a very pretty 3D JRPG, and it got a really cool sprite recreation on the Neo Pocket. There was also a Cotton spin-off on Neo Geo Pocket Color. Cotton, if you're not familiar with it, a side-scrolling shmup arcade game. It was released on the Sega System 16B arcade board.
It's also the fabric of our lives.
It was ported quite famously to the Turbo Duo, and that was actually one of a very popular game. It was also ported to the PlayStation 1. It's just a really fantastic shmup with a really cute anime art style. And it's the Neo Geo Pocket version is fantastic. Of course, a lot of the SNK IP software did make it over. Software IPs made it over, I should say. It had versions of the King of Fighter games, the Last Blade game, Samurai Showdown, Fatal Fury. So, I mean, it really had, like, a lot of support. It had its own two Metal Slug games. And even though they were, technically speaking, downports of Neo Geo arcade titles, they were completely rebalanced. All of the sprite artwork was redrawn with, like, super deformed sprites that animated really beautifully for hardware that was effectively like weaker than a Game Boy Color.
Yeah.
And just made these very, very playable experiences on handheld hardware where that wasn't necessarily very common to have like real fighting game experiences, for example. So it was definitely very, very cool. It had a really cool little like control stick that was a lot of fun to use. That was just overall just an absolute gem of a handheld console.
And I assume yours is still in your treasure box.
Oh yeah, no, I absolutely still have mine. So unfortunately, as we mentioned, and we're getting back to the main focus of the storyline here, Aruze ended up making pachinko machines using SNK's IP. So
and
you know,
you listen to Game Buoy, you know what happens when companies go to the patchy slot business.
Yeah. Aruze, for example, did a whole line of like King of Fighters pachinko machines. So yeah. In 2000, we did see SNK work with Capcom. And, you know, this is something we didn't talk about really, but when SNK formed, when they really started to beef up their in-house development, a lot of their fighting game talent actually came from Capcom. A lot of people that worked on the earlier Street Fighters 1 and 2 and the early revisions of 2 ended up jumping ship for SNK so that they could sort of have a little more creative freedom rather than being a part of the sequel machine and the revision machine, so to speak. They ended up collaborating with Capcom, though. You know, there was some bad blood for a few years based on the fact that a lot of their talent was sniped. But, you know, ultimately, Capcom versus SNK ended up becoming a branding. And we saw a handful of games, SNK versus Capcom Match of the Millennium and SNK versus Capcom Card Fighters Clash.
I wonder where you've heard about that before.
On the Neo Geo Pocket. Of course, there were Capcom versus SNK games in the arcade and on Dreamcast. So, you know, it did all right. Unfortunately, the Neo Geo Pocket Color games combined sold under 50,000 units. So SNK ended up closing all American operations on June 13th, 2000, the same day that they announced that they were dropping support for the Neo Geo Pocket. So, you know, it's very sad. Most of the employees' companies left, especially in development.
You mean the company's employees?
Did I say employees' companies?
Yes, you did.
My bad. So, you know, a lot of them went back to Capcom. The ones that couldn't ended up founding Dimps.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've actually talked about Dimps a lot here on the air. They're the guys, they're behind the Sonic Advance games. They've done a lot of work on, like, Street Fighter games, including Street Fighter 4 and 5.
Yeah.
They did work on, I believe, Marvel vs. Capcom 3. So they've done a lot of work over the years. They've definitely made names for themselves.
Didn't they do a lot of the Budokai games?
They did, yeah. They've done a lot of the Dragon Ball fighting games as well. So just a lot of really great work out of those guys. They worked with Nintendo on Kirby and the Amazing Mirror.
That's right, which is also a great game.
It really is. It's a fantastic game. So, you know, a bunch of other employees also banded together to form a developer called Breza Soft, which actually continued to develop games using the Neo Geo IP for Aruze. Toward the end of the company, or at least he felt that the company was coming to an end, Ekuchi Kawasaki-san left SNK along with several other SNK executives to form a company called Playmore in 2001. The original SNK filed filed for bankruptcy in October of 2001. And, you know, several other companies actually had the rights to SNK games at this point, which is how things like Brezasoft were continuing to use that IP. They were basically working for companies like Eolith and Mega Enterprise. But Kawasaki-san's new company, Playmore, actually bid on and successfully won SNK's IP rights when they were formed that October. So, you know, Playmore went out of their way to then acquire Brezasoft, since a lot of their former developers were working over there, still familiar with how to do King of Fighters games and what have you. They picked up a couple of other developers, including Noise Factory, who had done several Neo Geo games up to that point. They picked up a Japanese games distributor, Sun Amusement, so that they had arcade distribution abilities within Japan. And, you know, they ended up establishing international offices under the name SNK Playmore in 2003, because Playmore had finally regained the rights to use the SNK name from Aruze.
Yeah, it was a pretty bitter copyright battle, wasn't it?
It was. It was not cute, let's say. So they also picked up very, very notable Neo Geo developer ADK Corporation. That was the Alpha Denshi Corporation. They're probably most well-known for their work on the World Heroes game, but they also did work on Magician Lord and Ninja Combat, which were both early games. And they also handled all the port work for a lot of ports of Neo Geo games. The Sega Saturn ports of World Heroes Perfect and Twinkle Star Sprite, for example, were both them, so definitely some cool stuff. They actually made Twinkle Star Sprites, as far as I know, and Twinkle Star Sprites
just came out on Steam,
which just came out on Steam this week, is actually one of my top five favorite games of all time. It's on Steam, it's $8. It is just straight up an emulated copy of the Neo Geo release, but it's absolutely worth playing. It's a 2D shmup that is also a puzzle game, it's a lot of fun. It's a very unique experience. I still can't think of any other game like it. I highly recommend you check it out. So anyway, though, with ADK under their belts, they, you know, started to work on trying to build SNK Playmore up to be the rightful heirs to SNK, which was obviously, you know, very, very cool. A lot of us were definitely in their corner in this era. Basically, as a part of the fallout for Kawasaki-san's copyright suit against Aruze regarding the SNK IPs that Kawasaki-san actually alleged were used without authorization even at the time. Basically, they ended up getting something like 5 billion yen out of that lawsuit, which, you know, obviously was a pretty big deal. Unfortunately, you know, there was also a lot of other weirdness going on as far as SNK Playmore trying to go after other companies that they felt were using their IP sort of without permission. So SNK Playmore ended up ending the AES system line completely. You know, there's this whole issue with all these AES cartridges that were basically, SNK Playmore felt inappropriate, that they were illicit cartridges. So they just basically cut that whole arm off, figured it was time to do a new platform. I don't really know that they got to that new platform, though. They ended up working with Sammy and using the Atomos Wave arcade board for several
Sammy
of
their... Was Sammy with Sega at this point?
I don't think Sammy was with Sega at the time of the Atomos Wave arcade board. But it was actually based on Sega's Naomi design, which was itself basically a Dreamcast. So most Atomos Wave games actually do have Sega logos on them, even though, as far as I know, Sega did not have a hand in Sammy at that point. We ended up seeing some of the Neo Geo IP games get released on the Atomos Wave hardware, some stuff like Metal Slug 6, Neo Geo Battle Coliseum, Samurai Showdown 6, King of Fighters 11, King of Fighters Neo Wave. As an aside, also the amazing Arc System Works Hokuto no Ken game came out on Atomos Wave. Several of the Guilty Gear games were Atomos Wave games. So it was actually a really impressive piece of hardware there. Either way, and we need to move this along a little bit because I'm talking way too much about all this. SNK Playmore ended up also getting into patchy slot machines.
But not quite as dire as you would think.
Yeah, no, their goal at this point was to use the patchy slot side to spread awareness of the IP, rather than rely on the IP to, like, get them play in casinos or whatever. So, they ended up doing these games on Atomos Wave for about 2 years, and then they ended up actually ceasing production on Atomos Wave, started doing their arcade games on Taito's Type X2 hardware. And they also started to do games on consoles again, like PlayStation 2, the original Nintendo DS, the original Xbox, surprisingly. And we actually saw like most of their older legacy games get released on those platforms, specifically the PlayStation 2 and original Xbox. We then saw SNK Playmore USA work really hard to get their titles on the Xbox Live Arcade and getting Neo Geo games onto Nintendo's Virtual Console service on the Wii.
Yeah.
And that's actually cool because most of the SNK Neo Geo games are available on the Wii shop even now. You can go buy them. The emulation, of course, is impeccable, as you would expect from Wii-based emulation.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Those Virtual Console game emulations are always fantastic. And it is no exception, the Neo Geo support. SNK Playmore also has the notoriety of being the first to release an adult-themed game franchise on the Nintendo DS. That, of course, was Doki Doki Maho Shinpan. We did talk about this at some point. Obviously, this came out years before Game Boy was a thing, but we still talk about it. It's basically you're looking for a witch that is snuck into a junior high, and you use the touchscreen to like see through these schoolgirls' clothes to see if they have the mark of a witch on them under their clothes.
And then you can also see panties, I'm assuming.
Of course. So it's
and it makes you go very Doki Doki heart pounding.
Pretty much. It's garbage. It's garbage, but it's notable. You know, and they ended up releasing the King of Fighters 12 in 2009 because, you know, we're rapidly approaching here now. This hit in arcades 2009. It was sort of
a
huge return to form from a game development perspective. This game used newly drawn 2D sprites on 2D backgrounds, and you know, it actually only had 20 playable characters, which was a huge mark against it. The King of Fighters games typically would have, you know, 30, 40 characters per game.
I mean, we're talking about, you know, 14 coming up with
50.
50, yeah.
Yeah, well, and that's exactly, you know, they actually said that the reason why this game only had 20 characters is because they did all new sprites for it, and sprites are expensive. They couldn't make a game with more characters than that. They did release versions of the title on 360 and PlayStation 3, came out in 2009 of that same year. So, you know, there was not a huge lag there between the arcade release and the home release. That was actually, you know, it didn't do super well due to the changes in the game, including the roster changes, but they stuck with it and about a year later released King of Fighters 13. And King of Fighters 13 was incredibly well received.
Yeah, it was way better.
It is an absolutely beautiful game. It is, I would honestly say it's probably the prettiest 2D fighting game that there is. It won a lot of awards the year it came out, and so it's overall, you know, a really great entry point to King of Fighters if you're interested in getting into it. So in 2012, and this actually, I think we are entering the Game Boy era.
We are, because I remember you talking about this.
SNK Playmore released the mobile Neo Geo console, the Neo Geo X. This, of course, also has a docking station that resembles a Neo Geo AES console,
which is so cute.
Can be used to also play games on your TV, which is neat, potentially. Games were distributed on effectively like SD cards, but either way, it was a pretty cool little device and fairly interesting.
Yeah, it was only around for about a year though, huh?
Well, you know, it's actually that contract was extended. We had talked about this contemporaneously, that the you know, the licensing agreement was only really in effect for about a year, but Tomo, who who was distributing and creating it, stated that they felt that the contract was extended to 2016. They felt that they had performed all obligations under licensing agreement. And as far as I know, the product is still available in stores.
Really? I guess I haven't really looked for it.
So definitely, you know, super interesting stuff. And sort of getting to sort of the a little bit more of the modern day as far as this big top-down view goes, in 2015, Leo Technologies Holdings ended up submitting to the Hong Kong Stock Exchange that they were looking into an investment of a renowned Japanese video game developer. And the TLDR of this is that basically they ended up acquiring Kawasaki-san's 81% stake in SNK Playmore for $63 million. And the reason for this is that Leo Technologies basically wants to give SNK Playmore the backing to sort of do a mass media approach of games, comics, film, and television.
Wow.
But what's really interesting about that is that they have allowed the SNK group themselves to remain under the control of Kawasaki-san and has basically given them free rein to promote, to continue their business the way they choose.
So they're just business fanboys, basically?
So, well, hold on. So, as we had talked previously, as of April 25th, 2016, SNK has officially dropped the Playmore name from their logo.
And the patchy slot, right?
They have reintroduced its original slogan, "The Future Is Now," and they have ended their development and work in the patchy slot market. They are now focused wholly on gaming, and they're specifically with an eye toward developing their IP so that in the future they can work on character licensing as business. So that's where we are now, where SNK basically, through a series of very shrewd business maneuvers, has done exactly what we continue to say that, you know, some of these old Japanese titans, where they need to find a way to get some leverage, to reposition themselves. We talk about Capcom is in danger, we need them to do something. This is exactly, like, this corporate history of SNK is exactly what we hope these other legacy companies can do.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a very different story than Konami, for example.
Well, absolutely. So, King of Fighters 14 now is all lined up to release August 23rd, 2016, and later that same week in Japan and Europe, it'll be releasing on the PlayStation 4. And, you know, as far as I'm aware, though the game is designed in 3D, the reason for that, as we've discussed here on the show, is so that they could create the game that their fans expect. And, you know, I see a lot of people complain online about how King of Fighters 14 looks like a PS2 game. First off, I disagree with that. I think you're misremembering what PS2 games looked like. But further, when you watch the game in motion, it moves exactly the way the old games would move. It's absolutely true to the sprite animations of the originals. Very similar to what the Guilty Gear guys, Arc System Works, did in that space, where they did 3D models that move in 2D as well. So it's very exciting stuff, and I'm really excited for this game, and you know, hopefully it does well so that we can see other revivals. I would love to see something like Goro Mark of the Wolves come back. That would be fantastic. So we have about 10 more minutes here to wrap up this discussion, so I want to take a little bit of time to talk about some of these games. And Slaggy, I know that you mentioned that you have limited experience with SNK games, but you did have some, so would you like to talk a little bit about that?
I mean, mine would primarily be with like those things that you end up getting on Virtual Console, like, you know, so I mean,
Metal Slug, Samurai Showdown.
Exactly. But you know, like, something that I was thinking about, I was like, oh, we kind of talked about a lot of SNK when we were talking about our fighting game episode, like way back, like 2 years ago or whatever. You know, like, that SNK really did have like a lot of, you know, pretty well received fighting games. I mean, I don't know, I guess I actually don't know how the fighting game community thinks of World Heroes Perfect, but I mean, you know,
okay, World Heroes is not a super well-loved or well-received series, but King of Fighters is obviously super well-loved. Samurai Showdown,
Fatal Fury,
super well-loved. Fatal Fury, which is also spun off into the Garo Mark of the Wolves game, super well-received. The Last Blade, which we still talk about on the show fairly frequently, super well-loved. So there's a lot of love for these fighting games, yeah. Yes.
And then, I mean, you know, you have things like Crystallis, which is, you know, I think a lot of ways is an underappreciated gem. You know, I mean, but you have to consider that the RPG, the JRPG market on the NES was just very, I guess, would you say oversaturated?
I think it's probably fair to say that. At this point, you know, sort of working at it sort of backwards, yes, there's more than anyone could possibly have time for.
But I mean, you know, that's a definite underappreciated gem. And then, like, I completely agree. You know, Metal Slug, just a lot of fun.
Yeah, Metal Slug is a beautifully animated 2D side-scrolling shoot-em-up. Not a shmup, it is a shoot-em-up, similar to, like, Contra. In fact, that's what it was compared to when it released, was Contra. Except, what if Contra had really beautiful sprite work, really lush artwork, and a real strong sense of humor?
You don't think the Contra Bros are beautiful?
I don't think the Contra Bros are beautiful. I don't. Let's see. Obviously, Twinkle Star Sprites. I've talked about that a lot over the years. King of the Monsters is a really weird, sort of like arena brawler, top down. You basically take on the role of kaiju, and you're trying to, destroy each other as giant King of Monsters to become the new King of Monsters. It's a pretty silly experience. A lot of these games are actually available on the Virtual Console for the Wii. Probably the easiest way to find them. Also, you know, PlayStation Now carries a lot of them now. And I've noticed Steam increasingly has a lot of Neo Geo games. So that's also very cool.
See, what I thought you were going to say is that a lot of Neo Geo games kind of were a little bit playful. Or, you know, like, you know, maybe had like, you know, like kind of whimsical art styles or...
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that is absolutely something that I would say, in fact. And, you know, that sort of goes hand in hand with, you know, the fact that a lot of these people who were making games at SNK are people who left places like Capcom and were sort of trying to pursue their own creative interests. And so they did bring a lot more personality to these games than I think maybe they felt they could
in a tighter
corporate environment.
You think of things like Rasputin and World Heroes Perfect.
Oh my gosh, there is a lot. World Heroes Perfect, like the World Heroes games are not very super well regarded, but they have so much personality and they have a ton of cute little touches that it's hard not to love it a little bit. And you also saw stuff that was really cool in like Fatal Fury, where you would have there was a female character who was basically a drag king. She presented like hyper mask male. And in fact, you would only find out that she was a female character if you got one of her loss portraits that included her like cupping her binding that had come undone, so she had breasts. So it was just a lot of really interesting creative stuff going on there. A lot of character in these games, lots of personality, and you can't really go wrong with SNK games and Neo Geo games, in my opinion. There's a lot more good than there is bad, and that's something I think that any company would be proud to be able to say applies to them. Do you have anything else about SNK?
I want to hear more about this game called Top Hunter. Is that a new app? I mean, I know a little bit about Top Hunter.
Oh, I bet you do. No, Hunter is a really fun side-scrolling action platformy type game.
Space Pirates, right?
It was a Neo Geo release. Also came out on the Neo Geo CD, and it is on the Wii Virtual Console. Also re-released as one of the SNK Arcade Classics on the Volume 1 disc for PlayStation 2. It is a really cool side-scrolling action game. It does have some Space Pirates in it, Sidekick. And one of the cool things is that despite not being a fighting game, it does actually use fighting game inputs. So like if you were playing and you did like a Hadouken type motion, your character would still throw a fireball, despite the fact that you would expect these characters to be controlling more like a Gunstar Heroes or a Contra type game. So it was just a really cute, neat little touch. And you know, I'm always a big fan of stuff like that. Capcom did a very similar thing in Alien vs. Predator. It also used fighting game inputs, and it's just really interesting to see sort of the extra depth that those kinds of techniques can bring you. What do you hope for SNK from the future, Slaggy? Let's wrap this up so you can move on to your Spotlight Princess this week.
I think that despite the concerns that some people have about King of Fighters 14, I think that it's a good sign that they're, you know, really buckling down on their IP. And I mean, I really hope that, you know, it seems like the corporate environment's very healthy and very focused on, you know, celebrating their rich roster of IP. So I'd like to really see, you know, some of these things come back.
Absolutely. You know, I completely agree. I would love to see the return of Top Hunter, the return of Twinkle Star Sprites, the return of King of Monsters. I probably don't need a new Mutation Nation or World Heroes, but
what if it's
I'd
a,
love
what
to
if
see
it's
a new Crystalis game.
What if it was a World Heroes dating game and it was gay dating as Rasputin?
Okay, I would be so into gay dating as Rasputin in the World of Heroes world.
He's like, let's spin world around and make woohoo with a bunch of roses.
Ah!
I mean, I know that's a sim.
But yeah. I basically completely agree. I hope that King of Fighters 14 really takes off and that, you know, that becomes a new launch pad for future success for SNK.
Well said.
All right. Well then, Slaggy, I know you had a Spotlight Princess ready for us.
Yes, I would like to Spotlight Princess The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask. This, of course, is the N64 classic. Originally came out in Japan on April 27th, 2000. And a few months later, October 26th, 2000, in North America, and a month later, November 17th, 2000, in Europe. And this is a sequel to Ocarina of Time. And I mean, I guess it's a sequel to the storyline, or the, you know, the timeline where Link comes back to his childhood time. Because, you know, Ocarina of Time basically is the reason why there's all of these branching timelines at this point. But the conceit of Majora's Mask is that it operates on a 3-day cycle. It's obviously not real time, but you have 72 hours until the land of Termina will be destroyed by a very spooky apocalyptic moon. And basically, through the power of your ocarina, having to solve a variety of puzzles and not only that, but also interacting with just a very strange little cast of characters to kind of solve their personal dramas. And then as a result, you end up getting all these, you know, different masks that, you know, some characters are looking for a certain mask or will react in a certain way, give you certain things when you wear the masks. And then, of course, the three main masks, I say, you know, there's three main masks, but maybe four, but, you know, the three main ones I'm thinking of are the Deku Scrub mask, the Goron mask, and the Zora mask, which each allow you to have different abilities that just are so naturally fit in with the gameplay. You know, I mean, it runs on the Ocarina of Time engine, but, you know, the gameplay experiences, you know, with the Deku Scrub, you can shoot little bubbles, or you can fly when you launch from a Deku Flower. As Goron Link, you can roll around and you have, like, you know, really strong punches. And Zora Link is able to, you know, swim really fast and walk on water. And, you know, all these different play styles just feel so natural, to the point where, some of my favorite 3D Zelda gaming experiences are, like, you know, rolling around as the Goron. And, you know, like, I think that, honestly, the core gameplay of Majora's Mask is stronger than Ocarina of Time, because it took what...
I would agree with that statement,
It took
continue.
What Ocarina of Time did well and found ways to expand upon it. So, with that said, you know, that's kind of the overall idea of Majora's Mask. It did get a release for the 3DS, finally, just in February 2015, Majora's Mask 3D, which we, of course, talked about here on the show as it was coming up. And it's just a delight of a game, just very whimsical. It is the first appearance of our beloved fairy friend, Tingle, and, I think I always feel that where Zelda really shines is when it steps away from the regular tropes of Zelda, you know, Hyrule, Ganondorf, yada, yada, yada. And this was, like, one of the really notable times where, you know, the franchise did this, you know, Link's Awakening being another one where, you know, it takes place in a completely different land. And then, you know, you followed this up with Wind Waker, which, you know, totally, you know, played with a bunch of, kind of subverted a lot of of the tropes that you're used to. I almost think of Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask as kind of like one experience that is, you know, really like the best thing to do is, you know, to play them both. But, you know, you really can get a lot out of Majora's Mask on its own. You know, the music is fantastic. And just a really, really unique game. You know,
it's also one of the few Zelda games that is really sort of structurally itself, rather than having its structure exist only in sort of reference to the other Zelda games. It absolutely does its own things. It has its own cues. It's one of the few Zelda games that I really, really like. I don't have a whole lot negative to say about.
Indeed.
I'm so happy you didn't pick like Ocarina of Time, because I'd just be sitting here like, I mean, this game's boring.
I think Ocarina of Time is a very, very important game in the history of gaming.
I think Pong is a very important game in the history of playing, but I don't ever want to play it again.
I think Pong was important too, but I mean, her point here on Spotlight Princess is to kind of highlight, not necessarily
Spotlight
like...
Spotlight Princess is whatever you want it to be. And when I do it, it's whatever I want it to be. That's the beautiful thing about a show with two hosts.
I just feel like, I mean, yes, but my point was, I don't think that there would have really been much of a point to talk about Ocarina on Spotlight Princess because it has already been a game that's been discussed so much by everybody.
Okay, I actually do agree with that statement completely. All trolling aside, I think you're absolutely right.
So yeah, I mean, it's very easy to find if you do not own a 3DS, you know, and I was going to be like, well, if you don't, go get a 3DS, but I'm not going to be that type of person. You know, the other easy way to get it would be on the Wii Virtual Console, so.
Indeed. All right, well, with that having been said, unless you have anything else, it's time to launch into a rumor.
Oh my.
Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it.
So we have a pretty big rumor here that, according to a sources of that Kotaku has, we will be getting two new Xbox Ones in the next year. The first is the, at this point, expected sort of slimmer, smaller console. However, apparently, in 2017, we will be getting a new, more powerful Xbox One.
Wait, I thought they said they weren't going to do the Sony thing.
Ah, well, you know how these things go. Supposedly, the internal code for the more powerful Xbox One is the Xbox Scorpio. And supposedly, it is an absolute beast of a machine. Kotaku, they have sources. Polygon has sources. And they all swear that we're going to be seeing the Slim announced for release at E3 with a release fairly soon.
Oh, wow.
And for them to sort of tease the release of Scorpio next year.
Well, I feel like Sony and Microsoft are both looking at that NX and saying, uh-oh.
Well, it definitely makes more sense to me because, you know, these guys, the hardware people at that level, like Nintendo knows what Sony's doing. Microsoft knows what Sony's doing. They don't all have, like, many secrets from each other, per se. I mean, obviously what they're, like, currently developing and researching would be, but once their plans are in place to the point that they've already, like, ordered hardware allocations, which in this case Microsoft would already have had to do if this thing is launching this year. They already know that. The other guys, Nintendo, Sony, they know that already. And so it's starting to make a little more sense now why Nintendo wouldn't be bringing the NX to E3. I imagine now that their goal is really going to be to maybe in August or September do their own event and just, you know, have all of the attention to themselves, have the entire gaming world looking at their announcement, not at the announcement of the NX and the Scorpio and the Xbox Slim and the PS4K Neo, whatever it's called.
Hey, Neo is a SNK trademark. Be careful. You know what happens when you try to use SNK trademark?
Ah!
Let's just say you won't be able to play it more.
Ah, LOL.
Because you'll be bankrupt and you won't be able to afford games.
I did get that. All right, well, let's move this conversation forward. Begin winding down by talking about what's up.
I said, hey, what's going on?
The This week, I have been playing exactly one game, but yeah. I have been playing a lot of that game. If you guessed Overwatch, you must be prescient. Basically, I've been putting a ton of time into Overwatch. You know, I'm always making the joke that I don't really play first-person shooters or whatever. I clearly do at this point. Like, I clearly Destiny. Do. Right? Well, exactly. So,
except Destiny and Overwatch are both like examples of really good first-person shooters.
Well,
and there's a lot of first-person shooters that aren't super friendly and accessible for people.
Oh, well, absolutely. Either way, Overwatch is a phenomenally designed game. And the thing is, you know, you have Blizzard. They have been making games for so many years. As we talked about when we talked about Blizzard, their focus has sort of always been sort of that perfect tuning of the player experience, sort of
right.
Really balancing everything right, but also putting a ton of work into like the presentation and the user experience overall so that every aspect of the game clicks. And they absolutely brought like full force to the table with Overwatch. There are things about Overwatch that if any other game did them, I wouldn't like them. But in Overwatch, I am completely addicted. Stuff like all of your like skins and stuff you unlock randomly, sometimes after matches or like when you level up with enough experience. I would hate that sort of system in any other game. In Overwatch, I'm completely addicted. I am running on the treadmill. I am nipping at the carrot. I am fully on board.
Yeah, Blizzard does a good job of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I cannot speak highly enough of Overwatch. It would be impossible for me to say as many good things about that game as I want to say. Slaggy, what have you been playing?
Well, I'd just like to give a disclaimer right now that this podcast is not sponsored by anybody, and it is specifically not sponsored by Blizzard, because I have been playing a little more of World of Warcraft. You know, I was finishing up a very busy period at work, and so I didn't get a lot of time to, you know, do much, but again, just kind of trying to keep up on, you know, my garrison, get my druid leveled a little bit, so not really in a rush there. You know, we still have a couple months until Legion hits. I don't want to just, like, rush to 100, so I'm just kind of taking my time. But I also have gotten back into Hearthstone, kind of actually getting clobbered mostly, but still really appreciating what a well-designed game it is, and you know, really just feeling like, you know, I mean, I've been out of it for so long, I just need to, you know, figure out how to make better decks, and you know, because I mean, that's a lot of it. Like, I see, like, you know, like these mages, these Jaina Proudmoore's, like, oh, you mirror image, and then they're like using things to like freeze. I'm like, and it seems like a lot of where Hearthstone has gone, at least just from my couple days of being back in it, like, I have some druid cards that let me, like, use the Moonfire spell or the Starfire spell, so that, like, it kind of feels more like playing the WoW class rather than just, like, oh, I'm gonna just use my gnomish engineer that summons a little mechanical dragonling. Like, really trying to add the flavor of the classes in. And I really like that. So, I mean, that's primarily been it. Played a little bit of Smash and a little Rock Band, you know, but I mean, those almost kind of go without saying. Yeah, so it's been a very Blizzard buoy for me.
Excellent. You know, I also played a little Hearthstone, but mostly, man,
yeah,
the shooting mechanics in Overwatch just feel so good that that's just all I want to play right now.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely intend to pick it up, so that should be happening soon. .gift.
All right. Well, in any event, let's start really wrapping this thing up now. Slaggy, I believe you have some social links for us this week.
We do have some social links. So I'd like to go over to Twitter first, where we asked question of the week. This week, we're looking at the history of SNK. Which of their games are your favorite? So we got a response from Braun Dwarf saying probably the original Metal Slug. Incredible sprite work and just the right length for a weekend afternoon playthrough. ActDef said the King of Fighters series, though Super Sidekick is also a nostalgic favorite of mine. Your Enzyme says, I know SNK was important, but I can't think of any games from them that I've played. Frowny face. So well, turn that frown upside down. Hopefully we jogged your memory. And
if we didn't, now you have a list of some games you should look into when you have some time.
Indeed. That retro code saying Samurai Showdown, Spin Masters, Sengoku 3, and of course Metal Slug 3.
Excellent. That is a great little list you've got right there.
Other than that, we just have a couple of other Twitter tweets to catch up on. Still didn't hear back from a Hamboner 24. 469 about that LinkedIn, so sorry about that. Your Enzyme had asked what's the topic this week, which was for last week, and it was our pre-3 discussion, so we hope that you enjoyed that, Your Enzyme and everyone else. Your Enzyme also said, just thinking, with Mass Effect Andromeda right around the corner, 2017, and ME3 being the topic of episode 1, Mass Effect buoy? And I had replied that it was funny because we were, you know, talking about that, about how, you know, Mass Effect 3 was our first episode, and, you know, all the way back in episode 1, and... So Yarns have said that I'm excited. You two have come a long way since episode 1. And then said, I'm going into GameBuoy.org withdrawals. So I'm sorry about that. I had, like I said, a kind of hectic work week, and so the episode got up a little bit later on the actual, you know, GameBuoy.org website. So apologies for those of you who rely on that to be up on the feed.
Excellent. You know, I just have to say, I think Your Enzyme might be onto something with that.
Oh, about the Mass Effect buoy?
Yes. You were continuing to talk, so I wanted to not cut you off for once, but he definitely is onto something there. It's definitely something we've talked about ourselves. And
oh, yeah, because we only really talked about, you know, the...
certain facets of the third game.
Yeah, exactly.
So we definitely have a lot to say about Mass Effect, and...
Well, I mean, I have
a lot
of... I'd
be shocked if it wasn't coming.
I have a lot to say about 2 and 3. I don't have a lot to say about 1, but...
See, 1 is my favorite.
I'll have to slog through it. I just... Anyway.
See, and that's the funny thing is that, like, to you, and admittedly to a lot of people, it's such a slog, but to me, it's like, that is my favorite as a game experience. Like, it's the only one that is, to me, feels like the story is not the most important part of the game. And, you know, that's really sort of my sensibility, so it's not okay. That surprising. I just feel like it's a little more gameplay focused than the other two, which, you know, I will also say, though, Mass Effect was a big part for me in really getting into game narratives and realizing, you know, that game narratives do have a very unique position with regard to storytelling potential.
I love that. I'm not going to respond, not in, like, a rude way, but only because otherwise this is going to turn into Mass Effect buoy right now. Because I could
Would
literally...
that be so bad?
Well, we've got a time counter. Mr. Timer is ticking away. Last but not least, Your Enzyme said, I didn't care about the Uncharted 4 / Washington Post drama, but the review was just bad. Many criticisms were wrong on opinion. So, yeah, I mean, like, even, if, you know, I mean, despite the... you know, the quality of the review. It sucks when people respond to it in an unhealthy way.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really the controversial thing for me is the unhealthy response. I actually didn't really like or agree with that review, even just as I read it. But that really, to me, is completely secondary to the fact that it's inappropriate to respond that way to something like that.
But speaking of responses, and hopefully not eliciting an unhealthy response from any of you, we love your feedback.
We do. We love it.
We appreciate your listenership, whether it be through iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Google Play, which as of recording, I have submitted it. By the time you listen to this, it'll probably be hopefully accepted on Google Play.
Woohoo! Party!
And we appreciate your subscriptions, your ratings, reviews, any sort of interaction that you do on those, you know, aggregators, I guess you could call them, because there's so much more than iTunes. Now.
Yeah.
And on social media, we like your Facebook likes and we fucking love Twitter.
We've actually dropped enough F-bombs that I'm not too worried about it. So yeah, we fucking love Twitter.
I'm going to say, like, we use the explicit tag. There's really no reason that we have to censor ourselves, but, you know
it's better I like to say, use that language sparingly so that when you do use it, it has the effect of, like, May's ultimate in Overwatch that will just completely change the course of a match.
Oh, you. Also, I like to say effing love Twitter too, like just as the word effing. And we also appreciate any emails that you happen to send over to mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
So anytime you want to mail us, or, you know, even just if it's about an old episode, or if your response to a particular week's topic is longer than would fit in a typical social media response, please mail us there. And as ever and always, our home base is gamebuoy.org.
Home base, gamebuoy.org.
Wow, someone was a little off the ball with that. So I'm going to pitch it over to you at vognetwork.com.
All right, as ever and always, my first shout out goes to Girls Gone Wow, where you can have a female's perspective on the world's most popular MMO.
Also, you can hear us on VOG Network.
They're on the VOG Network, as is Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues.
Careful, there's going to be SNK-style lawsuit. Pfft.
Do you know who else is on VOG Network?
Me!
And the show that I do with Shane Alenko, Ranger Pridecast, where we talk about the current season of the Power Rangers meta series, as well as the current series of the Super Sentai Japanese television series upon which they're based. You should also on VOG check out the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail. In non-VOG shows, you should check out the Nintendo Love Fest, which does exactly what it says on the tin, as well as their sister show X Nation, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. You should also check out the archives of Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man. They're currently on hiatus, but much like other shows that have been on hiatus, we will continue to show our love for them until they spontaneously come back to life.
Speaking of one that's not spontaneous, just off-season.
His reading is fundamental. This is Slag Kick's show about the current season of RuPaul's Drag Race, featuring myself, Delvin from VG Realness, Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio, and, Slag Kick, who hosts the whole thing. We have a good time. I definitely get more catty than usual. I brought a little bit of that to this show today, and I apologize, Slag. Yeah, I did not mean to come for you earlier. I don't know when I came for you, but I came for you.
I'm feeling very attacked.
That was the correct response. Take us a place.
Well, I want to take you to a game bar. Game Bar is the gay video game Prairie Home Companion and a part of the Hunty Bunch, which is what we call our LGBTQ and ally podcasts that, you know, we just have been supporting us for so long out there in the indie scene. That goes for VG Realness as well. Video Game Realness serves up a weekly dose of gaming chit chat among friends and doing a lot of great streaming content. So check it out over on their YouTube at YouTube Video Game Realness over there. Also like to shout out to La Palanca podcast. Y para gay gamers Latino Americanos en Español. And also shout out to the Joystick Jockeys. DJ and Ruben are two LGBTQ gamers who love games and love talking about them. And yes, they are LGBTQ cuties. And I would like to give a big shout out to our allies over at the Nintendo Fun Club, which is your place for platformers, positivity, and pop punk, as well as the DSZ podcast, where Crystal and Dan, the Game Buoy super fans, level up their game development skills and discuss the daily grind along the way on a non-daily schedule. And in terms of shows that aren't part of anime... Oops, aren't part of the Hunty Bunch, but rather are a sister show of ours, is Anime Buoy, our little sister ship that is your port of call for anime recommendations, news bits, and discussions that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. Getting into the double digits now, so it's on its way out in the great sea. But what unfortunately has docked permanently is the Zelda Reorchestrated project, which was the project that aimed to reorchestrate beautiful Zelda music into gorgeous symphonic sounds, forever pouring out an everlasting 40 into the Great Fairy Fountain. That Great Fairy is just getting tipsy. She's like, you know how the Great Fairy do it, though.
Wow. All right. Well, I don't know how we can top that, so...
You know how the Great Fairy do it.
I think it's time. All right. Thank you so much, our lovely and beautiful listeners, for spending this lovely Sunday afternoon with us.
Thank you. Just to clarify, I have not been dipping into the Great Fairy Fountain.
I hope you had as much fun listening as we've had talking to you today. It has been a real treat to talk about one of my all-time faves with y'all this afternoon.
Yeah.
We'll be back at you probably sooner than you're expecting. Things are going to be rapid fire for a minute while we're dealing with E3 shenanigans. But until next time, keep gaming.
Keep gaming.
Keep thinking.
Keep thinking.
And, Shakwa you.
Dr. Shakwa and her cerise ice brandy. Professor Chakwa, Cerise Ice Brandy.